We'll talk with a guest from the Center for Biological Diversity about new information and developments in the efforts to protect the monarch butterfly and the gray wolf. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Groundhog Day, Monday, February 2nd. Well, I hope Jimmy the Groundhog in Sun Prairie can dig out of the snowdrift that's on top of his burrow this morning. He is scheduled to make his appearance, and I am betting he will see his shadow at 7:13 this morning. We won't focus, though, on groundhogs this hour, which are not threatened in Wisconsin, but we will get an update on the monarch butterfly, which is. A new report finds the monarch butterfly population is up, with their winter population in Mexico at 56 million this year. That's compared to about 35 million last year. But our guest says the monarch is still not out of danger, and we will talk about what will help, and we will welcome your questions and your efforts. If you are trying to help the monarchs thrive when they migrate back to the U.S. this year, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Colette Adkins-Giese is a biologist and an attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity's Minneapolis office. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is the mission and the work of the Center for Biological Diversity?
Well, we're a national nonprofit organization, and we're dedicated to the protection of endangered species. So we use, we've got scientists and folks that specialize in legal matters, and we work to protect endangered species across the country.
And one of those species is the monarch butterfly. So this sounds like pretty good news from the population count of the monarchs in Mexico right now. Tell us what the latest count found. It says 56 million this year, up from 35 million last year. That's good news?
Well, you know, it's good that we didn't experience another decline, but this is still the second lowest population ever recorded. So last winter was the lowest ever at 35 million. And that's a more than a 90% decline over the last 20 years. So we were up at a billion butterflies in the 1990s. And although we're slightly up this year, the conditions for butterflies were really ideal in both their, and particularly in their breeding habitats here in the Midwest in terms of the weather. So scientists actually had hopes that the butterflies would rebound even more. But 56 million, while it might sound like a lot, it's actually a still the second lowest population count on record.
Yeah, that's troubling. We'll go into some reasons why this is, but first off, why conduct this count in Mexico where the population is currently wintering?
Well, so the World Wildlife Fund has been tracking monarch numbers over the last couple of decades, and that's where the monarchs gather in just a small area, forested area in Mexico. So monarchs experience this amazing migration where the ones here in the Midwest, these amazing super butterflies that can fly, you know, about 5,000 miles all the way from up here down to Mexico, where they gather in these huge, spectacular clumpings where the trees are just, you know, sparkling with orange, heavy with monarchs. And then they fly back in this multi-generational migration where it actually takes at least 5 generations to get back to the Midwest where they breed. But those counts take place where the monarchs gather in those Mexican forests.
That's amazing, too. Talk about that a little bit more, the biology of the monarch life cycle. So
right.
how do they live?
Right. Well, monarchs are something that I know as a child I was fascinated with, and my own daughter has studied monarchs in school and has gathered monarch caterpillars herself from the little prairie near our home, and has been watched that amazing process of metamorphosis. It's such a symbol of hope and how miraculous our natural world is. But of course, the monarchs aren't always butterflies. They start as these caterpillars. Like my daughter last summer found one she named Tiny. It must have just hatched out of the egg. It was just like a millimeter big, the smallest little caterpillar. And they're beautiful little caterpillars with their green and white striping. And they just eat milkweed. That's what they eat. She found one on a milkweed plant, and we took it in the house, and we just fed it milkweed. And over the next couple weeks, grew into this big chunky, bulbous looking caterpillar, and then the amazing process of going into the cocoon and then emerging with those beautiful orange and black wings with the white spots along the edges. And so the butterflies that we have here in the Midwest, they in the fall then will migrate all the way down to Mexico, and then when they come back to breed, somehow these butterflies can figure out how to do this, although it's not the same butterfly that flew down to Mexico. The butterfly that went down to Mexico will fly up north a little ways, but then will lay its eggs, and then there'll be a process of metamorphosis, and then its daughter will fly a little bit farther north and go through the process again. And it's five generations later that we have butterflies that make it back to the Midwest.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. So when will the monarchs be coming back to the Midwest?
Well, for me, that's always an amazing sign of spring. And it depends on the weather each year. But, yeah, that's something we can look for in the late spring, early summer. We'll see the monarchs coming back to breed here in the Midwest. You know, I know when I was a child, I grew up in Minnesota, and I just have these amazing, peaceful memories of, you know, laying back in the green grass and looking up at the blue sky, and in the fall just watching monarchs fly over my suburban yard in the fall migration and down to Mexico. And you could just see, you know, just a couple dozen every hour, you know, as you'd watch and stare at the clouds. And that's something that I would just love to be able to do with my daughter. But their declines have just been just outrageous. I mean, such an abundant species, now more than a 90% decline. It's like losing every living person in the United States except those that live in Florida and Ohio. That's how many monarch butterflies we've lost just in the last few decades. So it's really a startling example of how humans can really alter the environment and make it unsuitable for other creatures.
I have those memories too that you do, growing up and seeing monarchs all over the place. And now I remember reports from Wisconsin where people who are looking for monarchs were very sad because they didn't think they were seeing very many at all. Even though presumably their numbers are slightly up, what threats are facing the monarch population right now?
Well, the biggest threat is the widespread planting of genetically modified crops here in the Midwest, and the dramatic surge in the use of Roundup and other pesticides that use glyphosate. These are herbicides. So in the past, monarchs, some of their best habitat was actually within farmers' fields, because milkweed would be a weed that would grow in the farmers' fields along with the corn and with the soybeans and along the edges of the farm fields. That was some of their very best habitat. But now farmers can spray herbicides that kill every weed in their farm field and leave only just the crops, because they've got the crop itself is resistant to the herbicide. So we've virtually wiped out milkweed in Midwestern corn and soybean fields. So that's the number one threat, is pesticides. Climate change is another threat. So what's really happening, we're seeing happening with climate change, is we have a lot of weather extremes, like very severe winter storms, more droughts. So what's happened here in their overwintering habitat in Mexico is we've had really severe winter storms. And that's scary, because they gather together, all of them, from the eastern United States in the small area in Mexico. Now, back in 2002, there was a very severe winter storm in Mexico that killed 500 million monarchs in one storm. Now, remember, we only have 50 million left of the whole population, and one storm killed 500 million. And that's because they gather together, and if we have those extremes that are becoming more frequent because of climate change, it really could wipe out the population.
Let me jump in because we have a news break, and then we will continue talking about the threats facing the monarch butterfly and the efforts to restore the monarch population. And we'll talk a little bit about why the numbers rebounded slightly this year. And we'll welcome any questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with a guest biologist about efforts to boost the threatened monarch butterfly population and why it matters. While the monarch population that is wintering in Mexico right now is slightly larger than last winter, our guest says that the monarch butterfly is still in danger. And we will welcome any questions that you might have on how we can help monarch butterflies. Are you concerned about the declining monarch butterfly population? Do you plant milkweed to try to attract monarch butterflies? And we will wonder if you think monarchs should be listed as an endangered species. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Colette Adkins-Geezy, a biologist and attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity in Minneapolis. Colette, you were talking about some of the threats facing the monarch population. You talked about the use of pesticides and how that also affects the milkweed population and climate change. Are there other threats?
Well, in the past, a lot of concern was focused on protection of those forests in Mexico where the butterflies overwinter. But Mexico really has done a fantastic job putting those forests into reserves, and that breeding habit or that overwintering habitat really is quite secure now. So, pesticide use, the wiping out milkweed, and climate change. The extremes of both more severe winter storms and also drought, because drought can dry up the milkweed plants that the caterpillars depend on and also make it really difficult for the caterpillars to live because of a very dry environment. So those are the major threats. You know, it's hard for people to get their mind wrapped around the fact that such a species that had seemingly so abundant could be considered for protection under the Endangered Species Act. But and that's actually the very first thought I had when I heard that my organization was going to petition to list the monarch butterfly under the Endangered Species Act. I'm like, what? Monarchs aren't in danger. There's something that's in my own backyard. But as we started to look at it and we saw that data from last winter, the lowest population ever, we realized that, boy, it's just we can't be complacent about saving the monarch because we've lost a lot of abundant species in the past. You know, the passenger pigeon, that's just a real startling example of a species that people could never have thought could go extinct. And we're really facing the same situation with the monarch.
Well, so you are petitioning to put the monarch on the endangered species list. What does that how is that different than how we treat the monarch right now?
Right. So, back in the summer of 2014, we filed a petition with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to place the monarch on the list of species protected under the Endangered Species Act. And that would result in a lot of protections for the monarch. And we really think it's the best way to safeguard the monarch for future generations. So once the monarch is listed, it would be illegal to intentionally kill monarchs. There might be some exceptions so that kids and teachers could still you know, do what I've done and my kids have done, you know, have that joy of experiencing metamorphosis and raising small numbers of caterpillars. But it would be illegal to kill them intentionally. There would be a designation and protection of critical habitats, key areas that are essential for monarch survival. The federal government, in cooperation with state partners, would develop a recovery plan that would be really a blueprint of how we get the monarch back on the path to recovery and how we would get it eventually off the endangered species list. And there would be just a lot more funding for monarch conservation efforts, for teaming up with state, local, regional partners in trying to get milkweed planted and get the monarch back on track to recovery.
Yeah. I'm just curious, since pesticide use has killed so many milkweed plants, would it do anything to the use of pesticides, especially along roadsides where milkweed is?
Yeah, we would hope that it would result in restrictions in pesticide use. Now, you know, farmers really are part of the solution for getting monarchs to recover. And what we would envision is that farmers would be exempted from routine activities, you know, the plowing of their fields and the praying, even the spraying of pesticides, as long as they would set aside some areas where milkweed would be allowed to grow. And that's actually, having that diversity with them, their farm fields, is good for many reasons. You know, at the top of the hour, they talked about herbicide-resistant weeds that are taking over in fields across the country. And if we would have a mixture of pesticide, you know, so it's not just the Roundup being used and these just monocultures of glyphosate resistant crops, I think that would be better for farmers and for the monarch. And one thing that's important to recognize is that by saving the monarch, by taking these steps that are needed to protect the monarch, we safeguard other pollinators. Think about the bee colony collapse that we're experiencing here. With all this pesticide use, is really taking a toll on the pollinators, the insects that we need to safeguard our food supply.
And this, though, petition and the decision as to whether to place the monarch on the endangered species list, this is something that takes many months?
It is a long process and probably many years, but it, you know, we've already gotten good, well, we've gotten news from the Fish and Wildlife Service that our petition did present substantial information that an endangered species listing is warranted. So we had, you know, we filed the original petition in August of 2014, and then just now back in December, the Fish and Wildlife Service said that they were going to launch a year-long status review because the petition did present enough data that showed that listing was likely warranted. So they're going to go through a year-long status review process, and then at the end of that would be the 12-month finding that's required under law on whether the monarch deserves listing or not.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Colette Adkins-Geezy, a biologist and attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. We are getting an update on the monarch butterfly. A new report, a recent count, puts the monarch butterfly's winter population at 56 million this year in the wintering grounds in Mexico. That's up from about 35 million last year, but it still is low. It's the second lowest count for the monarch butterfly population, and we are talking with our guest on what is needed to help the monarch survive. And we are welcoming any questions you might have, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Dan in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Go ahead with your question or comment, Dan.
My question is, in the forests, do they have any forest rangers protecting the monarch butterflies, especially when they have snow or cold snaps? Can they put out, like, heating pots in order to keep the temperature high enough so that the monarchs don't die off in these severe winter storms? In other words, try to protect them like they protect the orange groves in Florida.
Right. You know, that is an interesting question. And I know that in Mexico, those forests are really quite secure. They are really an amazing economic boost to Mexico because tourists from all over the world will come to see that amazing monarch migration and see the monarchs come together. So it is highly regulated, their access to that forested area. But I'm not sure if they've looked into anything to try to prevent those winter die-offs. You know, the most important way to address those winter die-offs is to ensure that we have a big enough population that it can withstand those, big dips down. That's really how the monarch has survived over the millennia, is to have a really big population that, you know, could crash in some areas, but there'd still be enough left in others to survive. And mm-hmm. And that's why the big declines are so startling.
Yeah, you mentioned that these winter storms in Mexico have been known to kill off, you said, 500 million?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, if we only have 56 million, that would obviously completely wipe out the wintering population. Why does it matter to save the monarch butterfly?
Right. Well, boy, the reason why I really care about monarchs is because I have a sense of responsibility, because it's humans that are causing their decline. And what we're doing to change our planet with all these toxins that we're dumping into our environment, and the carbon dioxide that we're spitting out that's causing climate change, it's really, what's happening to the monarch is really just an example of how we're changing the face of our planet to make it less suitable for this diversity of life that just makes this world a more interesting place to be. I want to live in a world that's rich with all the types of creatures that are supposed to be here. And I want to have, you know, my grandchildren get the opportunity that I've had and my daughter's had to look at these just backyard beauties, these amazing creatures that do this, these really fantastic, it just shows how amazing wildlife is. Metamorphosis is such a miraculous event, and that the migration that monarchs go through. So besides the fact that just kids love them, they're a great classroom tool to demonstrate metamorphosis, I think it's just important that to know that if we save the monarchs, the things that we do, it's also going to save so many other creatures that are important for our way of life. So you save the monarchs and you save those pollinators that are important for our own crop production, which is essential for our own survival.
Well, and you mentioned that the efforts to restore the milkweed plant in the Midwest and a favorable, I guess, climate in the Midwest for the monarchs breeding. And they lay their eggs in the milkweed, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And so you said they had favorable conditions last summer. I mean, if we continue to plant milkweed and we continue to have favorable conditions in the Midwest, is that going to continue to see the monarch population rebound?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's so many problems that this world faces. They're just so complex, the solutions. But for monarchs, this is a problem that it's simple to fix. We just need more milkweed, and that would do so much to recover the monarch population. So this is something that people can help in their own yards to plant native milkweeds. Now, there's a couple things to be careful of. You do want to make sure that you're planting milkweeds that are native to this area. But you can easily order milkweed seeds from the internet and just say where you'll figure out where you live, and they'll send you the ones that are right for this region. You can also buy milkweeds at your local nursery, but you'll want to ask whether the milkweed plants and other flowers that are good for butterflies, whether they've been treated with pesticides or not, because unfortunately a lot of the plants you bring home with the nursery are treated with systemic insecticides, so you could actually attract the milkweeds to your yard and then kill them by when they feed upon the plants, if they're treated with neonicotinoids or other systemic insecticides. other things that people can do is just making sure that they don't use pesticides in their own yard. You want yardless little backyards can be a surprising piece of habitat for monarchs, other butterflies, you know, frogs, toads, lots of wildlife just by not using pesticides. And then helping support the organic movement, trying to purchase organic fruits and vegetables to help support that type of food production that doesn't involve pesticide use.
Speaking of which, Colette, we have a caller, Mary in Viola, with us. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Yes, go ahead.
I live on an organic vegetable farm. I used to be a dairy farmer for 20 years here. It's a 200-acre farm. My son actually only, you know, has about 20 acres in organic vegetables now. But one of the things that he did last year, or actually I guess 2 years ago, is that he planted milkweed. Mm-hmm. And I know that all the seeds that he gets are either from a place like Seed Savers or someplace where the seeds are not treated, as your speaker has mentioned. And we had a very nice, large population of monarchs last year.
Wonderful.
And as well, the milkweed really took off. I started to see it everywhere on the farm.
How great. And you did see a lot of monarchs.
Yes, I did. I did. All of us did. We all agreed, wow. I mean, one little thing like planting the milkweeds made such a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Colette?
Yeah, I'm so glad to hear that. And that's just an example of what people can do, even on a smaller scale in their own yards. I have just the smallest little patch on the side of my yard where I don't mow and I plant native grasses and wildflowers. And there's only about 5 milkweed plants in there. But it's enough to attract monarchs, and yeah, all the neighborhood kids come in there and look for the monarch caterpillars, and it's so much fun to watch that process of metamorphosis and see the beautiful monarchs fluttering around in the yard. Yeah, it is really something that you know, just every person can make a difference.
Jerry on Facebook says, did you know there are milkweed plants for just about any type of soil and location? I was planting dozens of those seeds last fall. I am now prepared for the coming months, or the coming of the monarchs. Well, thanks, Jerry. Carl in Madison is with us. Hello, Carl.
Yes, what a wonderful program. My mom was a person who loved the outdoors, and she passed away when I was 15, but just such a good and kind person. And one morning she said, hey, let's go. I got something to show you. And we bundled into the car. I lived in Southern California, and she took me to the coastline near Carpinteria, and we went into a eucalyptus grove, and I thought, yeah, it's really beautiful. The sun was just coming up, and all these, you know, reddish leaves on the trees, and then suddenly those leaves started to open and flutter down, and she had shown me this roosting site of these monarch butterflies, and a memory that will stick with me always, and to the point where when I think about my mom, that memory is almost synonymous with that sense of who she was. And when I see a monarch butterfly, which has been unfortunately too rare recently, it just brings me right back to who she was. And I just want to commend the guest for her work in this area. I've dropped my education career and started environmental work because of my commitment to making sure that species like the monarch have a chance to share this earth with us. And I think right now in this period of history is just a critical time for us to be involved in maintaining the possibility for future generations to see monarch butterflies. So thank you for your work.
Thank you, Carl, for such a touching story, too. Colette, we have less than 30 seconds before a news break. Are you hopeful we can save the monarch?
I really am. And stories like the last caller told really are touching to hear how much monarch butterflies can touch someone's heart.
We will check news from Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio. And then we're going to talk about another threatened species. Actually, the gray wolf has been put back on the endangered species list. And we'll talk with our guest about why her group is trying to get it put on the threatened list instead. Now we will discuss the latest developments in the efforts to protect gray wolves after a recent federal court ruling put them back on the endangered species list and stopped the wolf hunt in Wisconsin and other Midwestern states. I'm Joy Cardine. Our guest is Colette Adkins-Geezy. She is with the Center for Biological Diversity. And her group is actively petitioning to change the listing from endangered to threatened. We'll find out why, and we will welcome your thoughts and your reactions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And Colette, we go from monarchs to wolves, and remind us what happened when this federal judge ruled to relist the gray wolf in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. What happened there?
Right. Well, this was just last month. The court did reinstate federal Endangered Species Act protection to wolves in the Great Lakes. This is the third time that federal courts have struck down rules from the Fish and Wildlife Service that reduced or removed protections from wolves in the Great Lakes. So by striking down that delisting, wolves now are back on the list. So they've got threatened status in Minnesota and endangered status in Wisconsin and Michigan. That means there is no legal hunting or trapping or killing of wolves in Wisconsin and Michigan, except for in defense of inhuman life.
Well, so just understand that judge's ruling. He believed the evidence showed that the numbers were too low to sustain the killing of wolves.
Well, there were a lot of bases for his ruling. The primary basis was that the Endangered Species Act requires protection of listed species unless they're recovered in all significant portions of their range. And the wolf was found across most of the lower 48 and yet has recovered in less than 10% of their historic range. So while wolves might be doing, recovering here in the Great Lakes and in the Northern Rockies, the wolf hasn't recovered across its historic range. So it was premature to take wolves off the list of endangered species. The judge also looked at how the states in the Great Lakes have responded once wolves are taken off the list, and considered whether the states really are adequately protecting the wolves. And what we saw was that immediately upon being removed from federal protection, states Minnesota and Wisconsin started those sport hunting seasons, aggressive seasons. And here in the Great Lakes, just since 2011, more than 1,400 wolves have been killed by hunters and trappers. And that really showed the court that the states, that there's still threats to the wolf remain, the same sort of threats that got them listed under the Endangered Species Act in the first place. And that's really negative human attitudes towards wolves.
Yeah. Well, so why then is your organization and others are petitioning to change the listing from endangered to threatened? Why do you want to do this?
Well, so what happened in response to that court ruling that's reinstated protections for wolves is that congresspersons in the Great Lakes and also out west have threatened to amend the Endangered Species Act to remove the protections from wolves, so to basically override the court ruling and require the Fish and Wildlife Service to take protections away from wolves. And that's a real threat. So what we want to do is show Congress that there is a path forward where wolves can still be protected federally, but there can be this flexibility to allow some control of problem wolves. And that path forward is a threatened listing. So like what we have in Minnesota could be applied across the country. And a threatened listing is different than endangered because it does allow the Fish and Wildlife Service to pass a special rule that allows the killing of wolves in some circumstances. So in Minnesota, problem wolves that repeatedly kill livestock can be legally killed by federal agents. And we think that would be a great compromise where we still have federal oversight and protection, but that the wolves that are really causing these conflicts could be dealt with.
Yeah. And is there a big conflict between farmers and wolves when it comes to wolves killing livestock?
Well, there certainly is a big perception of conflict, but what the studies have shown is that the conflicts between wolves and livestock occur at only a few number of farms, and usually those are the farms that really aren't using the very best techniques to deter wolf predation. In Michigan, for example, half of all the livestock losses from wolves occur at just one farm in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And that farmer had been shown to be leaving, when cows die, just to leave them out in the field. And that certainly attracted wolves and contributed to the problem there. So there's a lot that can be done to address wolf livestock conflicts, both non-lethal and targeted lethal measures. But what we saw with when it turned over to state management is that we had these sports hunting seasons that started right away. And that really does nothing to help those conflicts, because what sport hunting does is to break up stable packs by just taking out random members of the pack. And it's these busted out packs that end up being more likely to attack livestock, because wolves need a functioning family unit pack to take down their big game, like the deer.
We are talking about the gray wolf in Wisconsin and talking about why the Center for Biological Diversity is petitioning to change the listing of endangered in Wisconsin to threatened, because this would allow federal agents to kill problem wolves. And we wonder what you think, what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Are you glad that a federal judge has ruled to relist the gray wolf and stopped the wolf hunt in Wisconsin? We welcome any thoughts or questions you have about that decision and the effort to get that listing changed to threatened. Colette Adkins-Giese is our guest, a biology and attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity in Minneapolis. Well, I know that Wisconsin Congressman Reed Ribble of Appleton is proposing a bill that would undo entirely the decision to list the wolf as endangered. But that's not what you want to have happen, is it, Colette?
No, that's exactly what we're afraid of. We just think it's a real dangerous path that whenever a species becomes politically inconvenient, congresspersons could amend the act to remove those protections. We think that decisions about endangered species should be governed by the best available science. And there is broad public support for protection of endangered species. And we think that there is a path forward here where wolves can still be federally protected, but that those problem wolves could be targeted, and that's a threatened listing.
Yeah, and if human attitudes are a threat, how do we change attitudes?
Well, you know, that is a hard one. I think that just takes time. And I think what we've seen and, you know, since wolves were delisted is that we just aren't there yet, because really as soon as wolves were taken off the endangered species list, there was this incredible drive to reduce their populations. You know, in Wisconsin, when federal protections were removed back in 2011, we had about 700 wolves, and the state management agency, Wildlife Management Agency, said they wanted to reduce it by about half, down to 350 wolves. That's just too low. That's not enough to be able to sustain the wolf population. And think about all the federal tax dollars and effort that went in to recover wolves in the Great Lakes. And then when the management turned back to the states, they immediately started to take away all that progress that had been made.
Yeah. Fred in West Bend joins us. Hello, Fred.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes, go ahead, please, Fred.
Yeah, I have two issues, and one I heard something about the farmer's predation was kind of his fault because his cattle were in the field. You raise beef cattle in the field. That's where they stay. They don't go in buildings. And I'm an archer, bow hunter, an outdoors person. I own properties. And I've had areas where I used to bow hunt deer and gun hunt deer and see a couple of deer every day up in northeast Wisconsin. And I can go there now and climb a tree and sit in the dark and wait until dark. And
yeah, you know, thank you, Fred. Because we're so short on time, a lot of hunters in Wisconsin think the wolf is eating the deer population. Colette, that's another issue.
Well, wolves are supposed to eat deer. That's the amazing process that they, you know, ecological role that they fulfill is they kill the sick and the weak deer, and it allows the herd to be strong by allowing that's the way it is intended to be. And what we had here in that situation in northern Wisconsin or Michigan was that the farmer was leaving carcasses of dead cows in his field after they died, and that really is just bad husbandry.
Yeah, we have less than a minute to go now. Joe in Cottage Grove saw the Budweiser puppy commercial in the Super Bowl last night, and a lot of people are saying that the that commercial perpetuates the stereotype of the big bad wolf. The wolf was gonna eat this puppy. Did you happen to hear about that?
I did hear about that ad. I didn't see it myself, but that really is frustrating. I mean, that is not the attitudes that we need in this day and age. And I think people really just need to recognize the important role that wolves play as predators of deer to help control deer populations. There really are too many deer in our forests, maybe not in the area where that particular caller had hunted, but overall we have too many deer, and it causes car accidents and it causes our forests to be changed from over-browsing, and wolves are an important part of that puzzle.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Colette Adkins-Giese, biologist and attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.